From the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing, China, this is the China in the World podcast hosted by Paul Hanley.
Welcome back to the China in the World podcast. It's a pleasure this morning to have with me Robert Daly on the podcast for the first time. Robert is the director of the Kissinger Institute on China and the United States at the Woodrow Wilson Institute. Prior to that, he was the American director of the Johns Hopkins University Nanjing University Center for Chinese and American Studies in Nanjing. Robert has a long history of living and working in China. Began working on U.S.-China relations as a U.S. diplomat, serving as cultural exchanges officer at the U.S. Embassy in Beijing in the late 1980s and the early 1990s. He left the Foreign Service and taught Chinese at Cornell University, even worked on a television show called Beijinger in New York, and other theater projects in China as a host, anchor, and writer. And he's helped produce Chinese language versions of Sesame Street and other children's television workshop programs. From 2000 to 2001, he was the American director at the U.S.-China Housing Initiative at the Department of Housing and Urban Development. He has testified before Congress on U.S.-China relations. He's lectured at a number of Chinese and American institutions, including the Smithsonian Institute, East-West Center, the Asia Society, and the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations. He has also interpreted for Chinese leaders, including former President Jiang Zemin and Li Yuanqiao, and American leaders including Jimmy Carter and Henry Kissinger. It's been a pleasure to be with Robert this week for the Aspen Institute's Congressional Staffers Visit. We're here live from the Sofitel Hotel in Beijing. First time doing the China in the World podcast there. Robert, it's a pleasure to have you with us.
Well, it's great to be with you. Thanks.
There's a lot to talk about this morning. Your center, in fact, has hosted a number of speeches as of late. Most highlighted was Vice President Pence, who gave a speech. But before that, Senator from Delaware, Senator Coons, also gave a speech. And in those speeches, we can see, obviously, that things have changed in terms of the Washington, D.C. sort of consensus or lack of consensus, but it certainly seemed to be pointing in a different direction. And I wanted to just start out basically to try to get a better understanding of how you digest all of this. What does this all say? This sort of much tougher rhetoric from Vice President Pence. Of course, Secretary of State Pompeo had a speech just a few days later. Particularly tough speeches, I think, I would argue, categorize them as. Where is this going? I mean, what does this say about the relationship where it came from, where it stands today, and where it may be going in the future?
I think it's a little easier to say where it came from than where it's going. But the Pence speech that you mentioned, and then Secretary of State Pompeo just a few days later at the Hudson Institute in New York, rather similar speech. Both began with long litanies of our concerns about China. And China would see these simply as attacks and slanders on China. And they echoed Pence's October 4th, 2018 speech at the Hudson Institute in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so this was a building on that. And so it was a list of concerns, mostly longstanding, mostly important, mostly true, and mostly very familiar to the Chinese. And, Pence sort of outlined in that first speech a view that said China's now a bad actor. It's a bad actor domestically on human rights issues. It's a bad actor internationally in terms of things like some of its Belt and Road lending practices and other things. And it's a bad actor on American soil. This piece is new because of influence on American communities. And now there's more and more discussion about influence on American corporations and freedom of speech. And so those concerns, you just mentioned a consensus, which I think there is broadly that this is now a contentious relationship for the long term.
So I heard you say this week that America has woke up to the dangers of China. Explain that a little bit if you can.
Well, China the Chinese Communist Party has had fairly clear goals about which it has been quite frank for a long time. And this is one of the reasons that China is positioning itself as wounded, surprised, not understanding how we could take this attitude toward China mm-hmm. when we were friends so recently. And there's a sense in which you can understand that because they've always been consistent about their goals, and we only started to object when we became concerned about their power, right? Mm-hmm. Which leads them to think that this is hypocritical on our part, mm-hmm. And it's just about hegemony. That's a convenient way for them to come at it because it absolves them of any blame and mm-hmm. of any need to make any adjustments. But the United States, I think, has, because China, especially since 2013, truly has become more aggressive mm-hmm. overseas and more repressive at home. I think that that's hard to deny. And that has happened at the same time that we are in the midst of what I think is our greatest political and even cultural crisis, probably mm-hmm. since the Civil War.
So it's sort of a nexus of China being more aggressive, more repressive at home, but also a bit of a crisis of confidence maybe in the U.S.?
On the American side, and real fear, obviously on the economic side, about what China means for American jobs, especially in the countryside and in the cities. And then more recently, concerns about how they have an impact on Hollywood, on the NBA, what corporate accommodations have to be made. And I think the broad critique, and it's not just Americans, Europeans, a lot of countries have it, is that the Communist Party is now leveraging its wealth to legitimize and spread illiberal practices overseas.
So let's pull some of those out. Let's look at the Chinese side first. More aggressive, more repressive at home. What are, and as you said, Vice President Pence a year ago laid out a list of grievances that the United States now has with China. The fact that China has noted this picked up aggression, which I think some built up during the Obama administration.
Right.
You saw in the second term of the Obama administration. But what are the areas you think that have really, as you say, woken American up to the danger of China?
I think the scale and some of the practices of what China calls the Belt and Road Initiative, which is China's overseas lending for infrastructure, brought in plain language, is largely what that means, is one of the largest factors. This is sometimes overstated, of course, in the United States. And beginning with Rex Tillerson, we spoke as though this was all debt trap diplomacy.
Right.
The Rhodium Group in New York actually did a study which showed that this wasn't true, that the usual poster child for this, Hanban Tota, the Sri Lankan port, was the only instance to date, it's early days, mm-hmm. In which China ended up taking over an asset. And in most cases, China has actually either written off debt or has renegotiated in ways that were more favorable to the borrower. Nevertheless, it's been pretty aggressive, at least in its declarations. And there's, combined with the infrastructure lending, is tech. And this is new.
Mm-hmm.
We've been discussing this week with a number of experts, terrific folks that you actually brought to the table here in Beijing. Both countries now agree that henceforth, you know, tech and the confluence of these emerging technologies is going to be the key to, you know, hard power, military power, but also economic power, soft and normative power, you know, worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's another new factor. And so on the one hand, it's a very legitimate lens and something that we have to be on top of.
Mm-hmm.
On the other, there's a sense that our certain aspects of Sinophobia are exacerbated by technophobia. They're all coming together mm-hmm. at a time when Americans are vulnerable. And so I see the speeches that you mentioned at the beginning, Senator Coons, I think, is trying to frame all of this in a way that might lead toward a sustainable policy going forward that still looks to cooperate when you can.
Mm-hmm.
The Pompeo Pence speeches, which are somewhat conflicted, are leading with our concerns.
And so let me pull out just a little more concerns, and I do want to get back to the speeches because I agree with you. There seems to be a different approach, certainly between Coons and the Vice President Pompeo, but even between Vice President Pompeo and Pence, there was a little bit of a difference there, and I want to pull that mm-hmm. out. But in terms of China's more aggressive approach and what might be what is causing frustration in the U.S., you mentioned the Belt and Road. You also mentioned, though, that there may be a little overreaction in the U.S. to some of that, and I want to come back to that mm-hmm. as well. What additionally, we've heard this week, for example, the South China Sea island building campaign,
right.
The issues around trade and economics. What are most prominent that are really driving the United States to look at China as much more, sort of, as you say, wake America up to the dangers that China presents, in addition to the Belt and Road.
Right. Well, certainly the build-out of the islands in the South China Sea and then China's response to the International Court of Arbitrations, finding that their arguments didn't have many grounds. I think that was probably the one single thing that caused the largest number of people in Washington to shift toward a different understanding of China. And there were, of course, predecessors for that. And we've always had friction in the relationship. But that was probably the one thing. I think that China's treatment of President Tsai and Taiwan, and then more recent issues like the Xinjiang detention camps, what's going on in Hong Kong, although the new framework for U.S.-China relations had already come about, you know, at that time. And so it is hard to, you know, disaggregate our concerns about some of our own weaknesses and failures from our concerns about China's growth. But the concerns about China and the uses to which it would like to put its power, I think, are also legitimate, even when they are somewhat overwrought.
Yeah. In fact, talk about the Kuhn, Senator Kuhn's speech. He makes the point in the speech that we'd be much better off if we were to get our domestic political house in order in dealing with China. And so what I hear you saying is that, yes, there are legitimate reasons why America's waking up to certain dangers with respect to China, but it also has a lot to do with our own weaknesses at home, our insecurities. And I hear from you, and I want to ask you to pull this out a little bit, a sense that in some cases we may be overreacting, the debt trap diplomacy, or at least exaggerating. If you could talk a little bit about the reaction that you've seen. You're in Washington, D.C. Right. I'm here 6,000 miles away. So help me understand, you know, what's going on in Washington, D.C. in terms of the debate.
Well, the debate, I say, keeps shifting toward a harder line, such that we hear from Steve Bannon, who I don't think is an entirely marginalized figure. Some I hear, say, don't pay any attention to him. You know, he's a has-been. I think he's still quite influential. And he describes China as an existential threat to the United States. That view is rising. And you know, we need to maintain the integrity of the perfectly good and alarming word threat.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Not all threats are existential threats. You know, threats means pay close attention and prepare. Existential is pass the ammo and reload, right? Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, and these are mostly Republicans, but this isn't really a bipartisan issue, has called China the evil empire. Again, those notions are growing. Bannon has also said we can't exist with the Communist Party. And this is being presented, I think, domestically, largely in terms of what China's economic practices are said to have done to America domestically, but also increasingly in terms of the freedom of speech issue and the way that China is insisting that companies toe the line. It is coming in with a very heavy, ham-handed approach. And this seems to have, you know, a few weeks ago you had the NBA discussion and you had the censorship of South Park, of all things. This one hits pretty close to home. Yeah, but it's starting to be less abstract. And so those of us who still think that we must remain engaged with China in some ways and cooperate, and that we have to try to manage this difficult relationship as well as possible, China doesn't help you make that argument. You know, as soon as you stand up and make that case, there's something else is going to drop that's even more egregious.
You this week had a good description, which I think helps to sort of, you know, simplify to a certain extent, of course. But you put sort of two camps: the managing the growing competition, and then those wanting to just outright win. Can you describe that a little bit?
So I think those who would advocate for managing the competition as well as possible over the long term, and I take this to be where Senator Kuhn's is coming from, I think believe that China exists. There are certain things that we can't change. We don't have levers that we can pull at a certain time with a certain pressure to get a definite outcome. The world is changing, and China's a major part of that, and we have to adjust and try to maintain peace and prosperity. And that means a dialogue, and that means certain kinds of engagement. And a partner in dialogue and engagement always gets some say in the terms of that dialogue and engagement, right? Something has to give. And so the goal here, I think, is to, yes, have a rivalry of sorts, but to try to manage it at something less than a full-on Cold War style in which a Cold War with China is the Cold War with the Soviet Union. I mean, you know, remember, you grew up in the Cold War as I did. It's part of the daily ethos of being an American. And I think that that's within our ken.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes time. The managing the relationship is in many ways a play for time, which recognizes that China and the United States and the world are changing.
Mm-hmm.
So it is in part a play for time.
But it is being clear-eyed, not being naive. It is putting forward the areas that are going to cause the greatest friction between the U.S. and China, is where we see things
absolutely
different. Absolutely. Dealing
and
with them head-on.
But being clear about them. Right now, evil empire is broad. Fighting evil is like, you know, fighting terrorism. You know, it's a fallen race. It's a fallen world, right?
Yeah.
That can't be the goal. So what we talked about earlier in the week, I would be very clear with the American people, the Chinese people, and the government. Our goal is to prevent your dominance of the Indo-Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
We expect to be challenged in that field. You should expect to be countered. And here's why. At the same time, we recognize your legitimate interests, and there's room for that.
Mm-hmm.
On sort of the Belt and Road kinds of issues, we should declare that we will let's use a less martial metaphor, counter's better,
mm-hmm.
the spread of illiberal Chinese practices overseas.
Mm-hmm.
You should expect to be countered. But we will also recognize and welcome genuine provision of global public goods
mm-hmm.
when the standards are right.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a clear message. And in either case, and this I think is one of the biggest things that's missing from the Pence and Pompeo
mm-hmm.
speeches, this costs. Americans mm-hmm. are going to incur real costs over the long run to compete with China. And we haven't faced up to that. We've said it's our greatest geostrategic challenge.
Mm-hmm.
When in history have we met one without incurring real costs? And we're not being honest about that.
Yeah.
So
that's the managing,
competition, piece.
Managing rivalry part. Then there's the...
Then there's play to win.
Time is not on our side.
The other critique is, this can't be a play for time. There is no time. We're mm-hmm. out of time. Engagement wasted time. It was a sucker's game in which China played the time better than we did. And we have to essentially throw down now in a play to win, with win being viewed as, it isn't clearly defined yet, something from either getting China to retract its international ambitions and focus its efforts domestically, including reform, but getting mm-hmm. it to sort of retract the claws or ambitions, if you will, and then winning up to and including, you know, overseeing the dissolution of the Chinese Communist Party.
And stunting China's rise.
Stunting China's rise. And this involves Americans in a number of efforts, but one of which, and this is something we have to ask ourselves honestly, it involves harming or stunting the welfare of one-fifth of humankind. And I think that, you know, we've heard a lot this week, Chinese interlocutors say, oh, you always say communist China, you always say authoritarian China. Well, we don't always say that in every article.
Yeah.
They overstate that. Nevertheless, it is a useful exercise anytime you're reading an article about China. Substitute one-fifth of humankind
mm-hmm.
for China.
Mm-hmm.
It does focus on the human and the moral dimension, which is still a piece of this. So how do we balance those security concerns with these others is a big question.
And what damage do we do to ourselves as well if we stunt China's rise? Because, you know, I just give four examples.
Mm.
Pension funds, university endowments, heavily invested in China, especially in Chinese tech. Universities. There's a number of areas across the board where our companies, some of our most successful companies, have a big part of their strategy in China.
So the companies and the universities and their equities in China, this is a little bit of a two-edged sword. Whenever they want to make the argument that their engagement and interaction with China benefits America and indeed is sort of a vector for American soft power and it changes China, they're increasingly subject to an accusation from Washington that no, they are useful idiots at best and traitors at worst in that they are building up China's capacity. There's an accusation now, sometimes implicit, sometimes very direct. Senator Rubio often makes a point that because China is seeking what it calls comprehensive national power, any activity that is to China's benefit is arguably to our detriment in a zero-sum game. But to play it that way, I spend a lot of time with universities, would absolutely hamper the American innovation system,
mm-hmm.
which is one of our greatest sources of power and influence, even in a contentious relationship. So we haven't taken account of the costs.
Yeah.
We've made our accusations, but it doesn't yet cohere around a strategy that takes our capabilities, our resources, and those of China into account.
And you said that managing the rivalry will have costs for Americans, but I hear you also saying that a strategy to outright win and block China's rise will also bring costs to America.
Well, and probably much higher costs. And in the prior strategy of managing it well, we still have a better likelihood of engaging our allies and partners, many of whom share our critiques, but don't share the view that this can be winnable. They deal with China, and I think perhaps in a more realistic way. One of the problems with these lists of complaints about China, the list of all the ways that China is bad, and this is many of these are moral, China is bad arguments, is that they only account for the things here that don't work and really are problematic, but they don't account for China in its totality and its complexity. Because you read about the surveillance state, and it's true, but you live here, you know, you come here, people aren't cowering in the streets.
Yeah.
They're still a strut. They're entrepreneurial. They're creative. They're forward-looking. They're internationalist. And our description that is only accentuates the negative doesn't account for China as it really exists. And so it's unconvincing, not only to Chinese, but to the world.
Yeah.
We can't have an effective China strategy unless it's a strategy that accounts for this place in its totality. And that's one of the other things we're missing, I think.
Let me wrap up with a couple questions about specifically about the recent speeches that may give us an indication of where we're going in the future.
Right.
Last year, Vice President Pence's speech was just a litany of grievances.
Right.
My biggest problem with it was it didn't offer a way forward. This year, however, he ended the speech by saying, America's reaching out our hand and we hope that soon Beijing will reach back, this time with deeds, not words, and with renewed respect for America. He also said America is not out to contain China. He also said decoupling is something that the United States is not interested in. What should we take from that? Is this a shift, a beginning of a shift to a slightly more constructive approach?
It could be. And there was a similar language at the end of the Pompeo speech. Now, the cynical read would be that this was insisted on in the short term in order to get
trade deal.
The president can call a deal for political reasons.
Yeah.
At the same time, if you cherry pick elements of both of their speeches, you do begin to see the outline of a more balanced approach if we want to go there. And I think that's hopeful, and we should encourage that and work with the administration. At the same time, and the quotes you just read exemplify this, the implication is still that China has to do all the changing.
Mm-hmm.
And China feels the same way about us.
Mm-hmm.
Both sides are convinced that it's the other
right.
guy who has to come to them. And we just saw Madam Fu Ying a piece in the Financial Times today, which exemplified this in spades. You know, it's all on you to come to us. So that's not a great spot to be in. Both of those speeches also had another tendency, which is on the rise and which is has a long history in America. Pompeo and Pence both took great pains to say, it's not the good and great and noble and kind Chinese people.
Well, especially Pompeo.
Especially likes
it. He clearly made a distinction.
And we hear this from the harder line, the Committee for the Present Danger China.
Yeah.
The people of China are either enslaved or imprisoned. Well, they don't vote here and they don't have polls and it's a big place with many views. But, and I mean, you know, you live here now, you know this better than I. I don't think most Chinese people feel that way.
Yeah.
I think China is complex and like us sort of have the government they deserve. And to say that there's an absolute separation between the people and their form of government, I think it's a dangerous disillusion on our part. It makes it seem like we face something easier than we do.
Yeah.
We really do face a civilization state where there's tremendous continuity between ordinary Chinese and even the more authoritarian nature of their government.
I think that what is dangerous about this is what the trend that's also taking place, in addition to seeing more of this kind of Pompeo making this distinction between the Communist Party and the Chinese people, is more and more people are coming to the view here in China that the Trump administration's approach is designed to damage China, to block China's rise and to undermine its political system. And so, whereas previously, you know, you may have some Chinese people who say, wow, that they're the U.S. government's looking out for us, the Chinese people. I think that gap is narrowing now because the approach is seen to be one that is out to damage China, it seems to me. Now, Pompeo, as you mentioned, now, where do you think, in terms of going forward, how, you know, the Senator Coons speech laid out a different approach, and that's really where it seems the debate is now.
Right.
So where there may be some consensus that the approach of the past is no longer, it's a thing of the past. We're not going to be able to use that. We need to modify our approach going forward. But there seems to be a debate on how we do this.
Well, we need a little bit more of a debate. The elements of a debate, the two views are clear. But it's not being approached in Washington yet as a serious policy discussion.
Yeah.
This isn't really happening. People are floating trial balloons in some cases, and they're putting cow pies under the desk and sticking M80s in the cow pies in others just to see what happens.
Yeah.
You know, we've got this new, Newt Gingrich has a new book out, you know, sort of Trump versus the world. The debate is necessary, but it hasn't really been engaged. And especially on the side that would, well, the side, I'm not sure that's a great way to characterize it, but those who would advocate for managing for the long term aren't as organized. They don't have their banners. They don't have their catchphrases. They are issuing position papers, but those aren't widely read. So we do need to have that debate, and there's really not much sign of it, especially as we go into an election season. I think it's likely to remain a muddle for a long time while China remains a little bit more sure of some of its purposes and remains on the move. So I'm not terribly optimistic.
And I have to say the debate is not taking place here as well. You heard it this week. This is mostly the narrative is this is about the U.S. is having problems at home and it's wanting to come to China and blame China for all its problems.
Yeah.
And it's out to block China's rise and undermine China's
political system. And that serves their purpose. I mean, I don't expect China to think it's the bad guy. I do expect Chinese diplomats and American watchers, many of whom are superb, to understand why other countries might think China's the bad guy and to explain that to their own government and to take account of for that in their discourse with us. And even that doesn't happen. That's worrisome.
Last question. You're a great linguist. And in reaction to the Pompeo speech, the foreign minister said, "Yi Pai Hu Yan." How would you translate that?
Well, you probably know better than I what the Chinese government makes of the Secretary of State generally, but it's a pile of nonsense, garbage, balderdash. Balderdash is probably being a little bit too genteel about it, but it's let's leave it at balderdash. We're using too many martial metaphors. Let's use some.
Well, Robert, thank you very much for being on the podcast. It's great to see you this week and look forward to having you back.
Thank you. It's been good to work with you this
week.
Thank you for joining the China in the World podcast. Be sure to check out more content from the Carnegie Tsinghua Center on our website.